This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 25th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. On today's show, we're asking how do you look after a legacy? From pop music to literature and scooping up art and everything else in between, we'll pick up everything creative in our cultural drift net. How will we be answering the question, though? Like this. Will Hodgkinson will be popping by to tell us how David Bowie led the world in musical legacies.
You know, in terms of turning his death into art, just like he turned his life into art. I mean, he's beaten all the other rock stars to it. You know, once again, he was ahead of the game. You know, right to the very end, he was Bowie, which is an absolutely remarkable achievement.
And in an interesting political time for statues, we'll speak to a sculptor making legacies out of stone itself about how she gets commissioned. Plus, we'll hear about Infinite Jest, supposedly the last great American novel, but one that's also notorious for being almost unfinishable. So how does it last? That's all to come on this week's edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So, how do you look after a legacy? We're going to start with musical legacies, as we still have David Bowie spinning on repeat. How do you look after what's gone before? Can you ever change the lineup of a band and keep the spirit of the original? Can your golden years as a performer become a burden if you guard their legacy too tightly? And who's done it well? Well, I think we'll ask pop and rock critic of the times, Will Hodgkinson, shall we?
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real.
The best custodians have been the Beatles, in the sense that they had this 10-year body of work, which everybody knows about, and for the most part, they've left it alone, which I think is a very sensible thing to do. There's also the Led Zeppelin legacy, which you could say is good or you could say is bad. And this is Jimmy Page. It's not nobody else.
Who likes to tinker with things?
He tinkers with things endlessly. And you think, well, do we really need another version of Houses of the Holy? But what he's done, I suppose, is he's ensured that all of those albums by these huge box sets and everything. And he has, in a way, he hasn't really moved on in the way the others have. You know, he keeps going back to them. He's ensured that they are, you know, for better or for worse, they are now in the classic rock canon, or always will be. They're these huge editions you can get, beautifully produced and beautifully remastered. So, you know, he's kind of kept the legacy intact. But in a way, you could say it's a bit dangerous to be trapped by the legacy in that way, because it stops you from growing as an artist.
Well, it's an interesting thing, I suppose. It's a similar thing of when things come out, when CDs first kind of reared their little silver heads, LPs would be re-released with extra tracks or found things or acoustic versions or things that essentially didn't make it onto the 12 tracks, say, the 40 minutes of the finished LP in the first place. Where do you sit on this? Because it's very rare that you go, oh, wow, I'm glad they've put that on. It's great. I can't take that off the hi-fi. You know what I mean? And I wonder what that does to legacy, the tinkering with original albums.
I think an example of that, I was in a record shop the other day, and one of my favourite albums is Forever Changes by Love. And I saw this album, which is quite expensive, about £40, and it's like a triple album, and it said, The Lost Love Recordings, The Lost Arthur Lee Recordings. And I thought, oh, wow, I must get that. And then I kind of thought better of it, because to me, Forever Changes is a perfect album. The songs on there are exactly where they should be. There's no extras needed. You know, I got into that album as a teenager, and I remember hearing the albums that Arthur Lee made afterwards with a different lineup of Love in the early 70s, and I was so disappointed. And I thought, I'm going to be disappointed here, because it was shaved down and shaved down and shaved down, and we don't really need to go through the waste paper basket to see the first draft.
Yeah.
So it's sort
We're
of
in the territory of Monty Python's Notes to the Milkman, aren't we?
Exactly. But then, you know, the rules are not clear for me or for anyone else. I mean, I love the Velvet Underground, and for some reason, you know, there's been lots and lots of Velvet Underground reissues. They keep finding new there's a thing called the Matrix tapes that just came out, which is all these live concerts they did in San Francisco. They just keep happening, and I'm a sucker for them, and I don't know what the difference is. I think maybe because they're a bit of a looser band, and, you know, to hear another version of Foggy Notion or one of these songs that never made it onto the original albums, I love. But it depends. I think there's something to be said for leaving a really, really great album alone, like Pet Sounds or Forever Changes or one of the Beatles, any of the Beatles albums. There's something to be said for not trying to find bonus tracks.
There's something interesting talking about Pet Sounds there. And we will update ourselves from 60s classics. But in a minute, let's talk about Smile. I mean, this was sort of like the Brian Wilson album that he was making, that he was going to make with the Beach Boys, which he didn't, which came out, what, 7 or 8 years ago, actually. Where do you stand on this? I think there's moments of greatness on that record, but has he messed around with his legacy releasing it in the first place?
No, I love Smile. I think the Beach Boys are really interesting. What happened there was that Mike Love kept touring the Beach Boys in name only, really. He was the only original member left, I believe. Around the same time, Brian Wilson, who'd had a lot of mental health problems, was you know, he got it together enough to present Pet Sounds and then Smile in their entirety in the early 2000s. I went to those concerts, and he was supported by a very sympathetic young band, all, you know, the Wonderments, who were all huge Brian Wilson fans. And they presented it the right way. And for me, I think it was absolutely fantastic. And I remember meeting someone who disagreed with me entirely. He'd been to the concert and he said, oh, it's just a, you know, it felt really, you know, an unpleasant revival. You know, he wasn't really doing anything. He'd been wheeled out. It was all awkward. So for me, those concerts worked. And I like the fact, I think it's okay to have this kind of, you know, legacy album, legacy artist, and present them to a new audience. Because for people like me, I wasn't around when those albums came out, and they're amongst my favourite records. So to hear them live was fantastic.
And we come on to lineups there as well, actually. So classic lineups, you mentioned Mike Love touring the name, the Beach Boys, without much of the spirit perhaps behind them in the early days. When I was in Hastings a few weeks ago, I did see a lot of adverts around town for, it was something like the Spirit of Slade, with Dave Hill was the only remaining member of Slade. Doesn't have the haircut anymore. In fact, doesn't have much hair anymore, but certainly still has the teeth. So it was very weird. It looked like a sort of like deeply photoshopped sort of album cover from their sort of 70s bomb. Well, that so is stuff like that, which you just think, oh man.
No, it's painful. And that's when you do, you know, when you're on holiday in Clacton-on-Sea and you see, you know, Les McCown's Bay City Rollers. You know, I mean, Les McCown certainly was a key member of the Bay City Rollers, but doesn't need to continue.
We started talking, we kicked off this by talking about Black Star, about Bowie, and that sort of, as I said, it's almost his last great piece of performance art was his death, actually, the releasing of the record and then his death. Maybe we can talk about that. I mean, you've obviously wrote quite extensively in the Times about it. There's been, obviously, for the last couple of weeks, there's been a lot of talk about it. Do you think that's slightly overplayed, the fact that it was a sort of piece of performance art? Or do you, I mean, it seems so purposeful, the lyrics of some of those songs.
It does now. It's hard to know. Bowie was never one to leave anything to chance, and it seems now that it was incredible to turn his death into an art form. The way he died 2 days after its release on his 69th birthday, and this, you know, there are all these intimations of mortality throughout the album. So on one level, yes, I mean, that's incredible. But then Tony Visconti did say in an interview that Bowie, he knew he was dying, but he did think he had a few more months left. And he was on the phone, I think, a week before to talk about working on another album. So, you know, it does seem like his swan song, but then we interpret things according to the events that then happen. So it could be that there may well have been another album in him. Who knows? But it does, you know, in terms of turning his death into art, just like he turned his life into art. I mean, he's beaten all the other rock stars to it. You know, once again, he was ahead of the game. And he's, you know, he's sort of shown you, you know, right to the very end, he was, you know, he was Bowie to the very end, which is absolutely remarkable achievement.
Can you think of any other examples, I wonder, of great musical legends that have been the custodian of their own sort of demise and have talked to their audience through it almost? I mean, it's a very macabre thing, and it is so far away from the kind of, well, maybe it's a far away from the spirit of rock and roll. I'm thinking about, you know, Burning Out and Fading Away and Neil Young lyrics there. But it's kind of against the grain of the spirit of rock and roll to lead your fans through your demise, I suppose.
It definitely is. Well, rock and roll, the one thing I felt about when Bowie died you know, I absolutely love Bowie. And I thought, well, he taught us how to live, he taught us how to dress, he taught us how to reinvent. He didn't teach us how to grow old, because he couldn't. And I think the one who did, you know, rock and roll is all about youth and rebellion and fun, and, you know, it's not about getting older, although now it is, because the first generation is either still with us or dying. I think Johnny Cash, I mean, he's a country star, obviously, but I think the American series of recordings he made with Rick Rubin are the closest that someone of that ilk has come to facing up to growing old and facing up to mortality, even though most of those songs were cover versions. But still, you know, when he's doing a version of Will Oldham's I See a Darkness, you know, it takes on so much more meaning.
And that I see a darkness, and that I see a darkness, and that I see a darkness, and that I see a darkness. Did you know how much I love you? Here's a hope that somehow you can save me from this darkness.
Just finally on Bowie, I mean, that seems like a musical legacy that will stop with the final track of Black Star. It doesn't feel like Tony Visconti. I mean, obviously there was such a close circle of family and friends and producers around him that stuff won't. I kind of hope that stuff won't leak out, and that, you know, any workings of a new album, two and a half tracks in, probably won't make it out onto the internet. What do you think?
I hope not too. It's the way of the world now, isn't it? That everything has to be out there. And it's not always necessary, you know. And I think this isn't a musical example, but Dennis Potter, when he knew that he was dying, he was very, very concerned about finishing these two plays, which I think is called Cold Lazarus, Karaoke.
Yeah.
And they are the weakest plays in his canon. And of course, he was one of the great British playwrights. Now, why? Because he was writing too fast, because he was concerned about getting it out. And I remember reading a quote from him saying, "My great fear is to die, you know, four pages to go." And every artist, anyone who's productive in a creative way understands that. But at the same time, you know, did it add to his legacy to do that? I mean, they're not as good as what came before. So, I mean, I think Bowie died at the height of his powers. You know, with the most remarkable comebacks in history after a 10-year period of, you know, of being away. But that's rare. So, you know, I think Bowie did it, Johnny Cash did it. I can't think of many other people who, when they knew they were dying, they managed to make something fantastic.
Look up here, I'm in heaven. I've got scars that can't be seen. I've got drama, can't be stolen. Everybody knows me now.
That was Will Hodgkinson, rock and pop critic for The Times. After the break, we'll find out how to immortalise someone in statue form, and we'll discuss the legacy of author David Foster Wallace through his mammoth book, Infinite Jest.
Travel in comfort with the help of the Monocle Shop. It's the place to select the best bags, passport wallets, travel guides, and, of course, the latest issue of the magazine to entertain you on your lounger. We have a great lineup of special collaboration bags with Porter in Japan, including the new Overnighter bag, ideal for a city weekend trip. And then there's the limited edition Remova multi-wheel, made from lightweight polycarbonate in a special monocle edition. Visit our stores in London, New York, Toronto, Singapore, Tokyo, and Hong Kong. Or shop online at monocle.com. Be the one turning heads at the luggage carousel.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, and today we're asking, how do you look after a legacy? This February, the great American novel Infinite Jest turns 20. The book, written by the late David Foster Wallace, has received many accolades and topped countless best literature lists. But its legacy is a fraught one, with the reputation of the modern classic that everyone struggles to finish, and a black cloud hanging over it with the suicide of David Foster Wallace himself. At over 1,000 pages, 300 plus footnotes, and notoriously complex plot and language, Infinite Jest has managed to stay popular against all odds. Lily Ames hears from a few Infinite Jest readers about how they understand this complicated legacy.
It's not a page-turner. It's not the kind of thing where you get into the story right away and you know what's going on. Even now, I think I know what's going on, kind of. But for a long time, I was just like reading words.
And I did go through the first 50 pages, the first 100 pages, the first 150 pages, with the faith that somewhere along the line, this would all click into gear and there would be, you know, I don't want to choose my terms too liberally, but maybe a plot developing somewhere in all of that.
I felt really good about like having the idea of having read it in the future. So I started and it was just so boring.
I can't give up. Like, I don't want to give up. It's become this personal challenge. I want to know, like, is there some great secret at the end that maybe something will become so clear to me as I finish it?
The entire book seems to be structured to undermine itself and make the reader want to put it down. But if you pass through those moments, you get to these incredibly beautiful chapters and passages. My name is Anthony Gerace, and I'm a photographer and artist living in the United Kingdom, and I have read Infinite Jest 3 times. The first time I read it was in my second last or last year of high school. And I was drawn to it. I went to a bookstore in my hometown of London, Ontario, called Attic Books. And I saw this sort of thick book with a bright orange spine. I picked it up and I read the synopsis and I thought that it must have just been the strangest, most interesting book I'd ever, I mean, read a synopsis of. You know, back then I was reading like Stephen King and F. Scott Fitzgerald, very sort of simple plots. And, you know, describing a plot where a video, a movie makes people want to do nothing but watch the movie, and all of the action takes place between a tennis academy and, you know, a halfway house for drug rehabilitation was just, it just sounded like nothing I'd heard of, and it just immediately got my mind sort of racing.
My name's Gavin, I'm a political reporter, and I got to about page 254.
It just seemed to be within the realm of things that I would like. I mean, I guess my sort of preteen years were Douglas Adams and then my teen years were Kurt Vonnegut, and it seemed to be a natural projecting forward of a certain interest in satire and a strange kind of modernity.
My name is Anna Fitzpatrick. I'm a 25-year-old writer from Toronto, and I read Infinite Jest in 3 days. Part of the reason why I wanted to read it was to prove that I could. There are a lot of books that do kind of have this acclaim and this reverence that I want to roll my eyes at, but that do appeal to me. And Infinite Jest was one of those where it was held up by so many people that I hate as an example of great writing. But the idea of it at the same time, the plot and the story and the writing style always appealed to me.
It's a good reference point, even if you don't necessarily chunk through it. It tells you something about who you are.
My name is Emily M. Keeler. I'm the outgoing books editor of Canada's National Post, and I've read Infinite Jest 2x. I do think that there is this cultural attachment to getting sort of that notch on your belt, or getting like, it's like getting a diploma where you can say, oh, I am proficient in this kind of party chatter because I've read this smart book. But things don't actually work that way. When you're at a party and you're talking about Infinite Jest and whether or not you read it, chances are good that you're not actually talking about the book. You're talking about yourself. And if that's the case, just lie and say you read it. Who cares?
It's suffering from the sort of curse of like the big novel. That becomes synonymous with the book, that it's too opaque, it's too long, it's got too much. And I think it's unfortunate because it has tons and tons of sort of avenues that it meanders down, but it's worth sticking with. And I think that like the older the book gets, the more opaque it'll get.
There are other authors who have died young and who have died under tragic circumstances, but not that many in our generation or in our lifetime. So I think that adds to it is that he is kind of this contemporary literary mythic figure, that there have been those figures before, but they're kind of so far removed in the past and they lived and died before we were born. I think there's this urge, which I completely understand, to want to be part of something great while it's happening. So, you know, we're reading the book within the decade after he passed away, when his contemporaries are still alive and people who knew him are still alive. And it's kind of being part of this giant literary moment.
It's not something that you can breeze through. And I think that that's the attraction of the challenge, is the idea of going all the way in to a thing. For most of this book, that attention will be rewarded. And that is certainly one of the projects of David Foster Wallace's life. Everything that he writes is kind of about what it would mean to pay attention to something outside of yourself. How do you escape this sense of being trapped in a mind or in a body? And, you know, as Ian Forster said, connect, only connect. How do you get out? And for him, the answer was trying to exhaust something by looking at it so closely. And Infinite Jest forces its reader to do that in a way that many things don't. If you are the kind of reader who likes experimental forms, up for committing to something that takes a long time, yes, it might be the book for you. But even if you are that kind of reader, it might not be. And honestly, that's fine. There are literally hundreds of thousands of books that are published every single year. And you don't have to stick with one from 20 years ago just because some person on the radio said maybe you would like to.
I've taken the rather zen view that one never truly begins or ends Infinite Jest. It is a sort of an infinite Möbius strip of a novel, and you get through as many pages as you get through, and you are sated by the taste, and perhaps you pick it up at the start, the middle, or the end at some time later. I mean, I've read 250 pages worth. That is a novel's worth of it. And there are plenty of great novels out there and very little time to pack through them. And, you know, I'm just moving on in life, man. We've all got to move on.
A report there by Lily Ames. Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace is published by Abacus, if you fancy the challenge. One way you might leave your legacy is through a permanent installment of your own face, or your bust, or all of you, in military dress uniform. Statues are often erected to immortalise people of note in the places they were best known, or where they did their greatest or most philanthropic work. Francis Segelman is a British sculptor who's made busts and statues of an abundance of famous faces, from Sir Steve Redgrave to Julian Fellowes and even the Queen. Producer Holly popped east to Wapping to meet Francis and find out how you respect someone's legacy when you're moulding their face out of clay.
I look at their character by reading all about them. If they've passed away, obviously I've got to read a lot about them. And with the large sculpture I did of Billy Bremner, I went to visit his, you know, the wife of the late footballer, and lots of his friends, and studied footage, video footage, and masses of photographs. And if the person is living, which they usually are, I'd read about them and try very much to get into their character.
And if they're living, do you meet them? Do they have things that they want you to do? You know, if you ever have somebody, you have to name any names, but do you ever have people that say, if you could just make me slightly slimmer, that would be brilliant?
No, actually, I haven't got the... I don't know if they're frightened to say that, but no, they don't say that. But I do like to meet them first if I can, because then I sit with them, talk to them about anything but the sculpture, talk to them about their life and get them to relax, see how they held their heads, which side they held their heads to, and see them in a very relaxed pose, and then I get the feel of them.
What you're making are very still objects, but how much do you have to consider the way that bodies move when you make these?
Yes, you do, very much so. I have only done a couple of very large pieces, but showing the movement on a still figure is very important. So you have to work on how to show that. And I showed it with clothing and with facial expressions and movement of arms and legs.
And how do you decide on facial expressions and on, we were talking before about you show movement through clothes, how do you decide on an outfit? Do you look for maybe a something defining they wore during their career?
With a footballer, it's easy because it's their outfit. They wore their footballer's uniform. And with people like the Her Majesty the Queen, she did choose the dress and the jewellery and the tiara. You know, that was wonderful, that whole episode of going through the sittings with her and seeing those things.
Do you have to also think about the context of where the statue will be? Do you have to think about where the location will be as to what you do with it?
Yes, you do, very much so. So, for instance, with a very large piece like the footballer and other large pieces, you've got to remember that you're going to be looking at it from below. So you have to think about what that's going to look like. And in that sense, you have to make the top parts larger so that they're going to show. And all the sculptures, all the busts, I like to see at eye level. So I have to make sure that the eyes are right, you know, from that level, and the hair and under the nose. So you don't, you know, you've got to get under the nose right, which is, got to look under people's noses, which is very funny taking pictures of that.
And are there any particular, not necessarily something that you've done, but any statues that you think particularly immortalise somebody well within their material?
I studied lots going to the British Museum and the Victorian Albert Museum, and just adore all the early Roman and Greek sculptures, and they are the most wonderful place to learn. I mean, that's the thing for any artist to do. Go there, sketch, take a book, sit there and do all those. That's just amazing. Their faces, they were the best sculptors.
And is there anyone who has had a particularly difficult expression to capture?
Yes, I think there have been some very difficult ones, and they've taken me a lot longer. So I'd had more sittings. I'm not quite sure why they've been so difficult. Maybe because I didn't have that rapport with them when they were sitting here. But the ones that I do in 2 hours, I do two a year, usually for charity. So I'll sculpt somebody in 2 hours in front of a big audience, and I managed to finish the whole thing, life-size sculpture. And it's very eerie because it's very quick work, and I don't know anybody else that can do it. And these ones, no matter how difficult they are, I managed to get them exactly right. That's so weird. So I don't have time to think of anything negative. I have to be positive all the way through. If I start being negative, I can't get the head right. So I have 2 hours, and the people all know that. So it's pressure, and I go into tunnel vision. The sitter is not allowed to speak, and I don't speak to anyone. And the sculpture is finished, completely ready to go to the foundry. I think those are my best pieces.
You've got a show coming up at the Tower of London. Can you tell us a little bit about what we'll see there?
Yes, it's a retrospective of all my work. It's in October 2016 this year. Oh my God, it's come so quickly. And we've got the Armouries in the Tower of London. I've invited lots of the people I've sculpted over the years to come to that event with their bust. We're going to get their bust there as well. And we're doing it with the Stroke Association as well. We're doing it for a charity that I support. And it should be a fantastic occasion to get all these people together.
Just finally, is there anybody that you is on your wish list that you would love to make a model of?
I definitely want to go through the royal family, because I really feel that the same sculptor should be doing all of them. You know, it shows it's something about having the same sculptor. And just anyone really that's done something really special in life, that has some positive aura around them, you know, that I feel excites me. So that's good. You know, anybody like that.
That was the sculptor Frances Segelman, bringing us to the end of today's show. To find out more about her work, you can head to segelman.com. So how do you look after a legacy? You keep it relevant, but you don't fiddle with it. You let a legacy speak, but make sure that it mostly speaks for itself. You protect it, but don't treat it with kid gloves. In fact, a legacy is best argued over rather than genuflected in front of. That makes it vital, interesting, and worthy of the name. You've been listening to Culture. My producer was our very own Picasso in the Attic, Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week for a film festival bonanza at Sundance and Trieste. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.